Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast. I'm Tim Burrows in Cannes. With me, Mark Holden, Global Planning Director of PhD.
Hello.
And Danny Bass, Chief Digital Officer of Group M.
Hello.
And Alex Parsons, Marketing Director of 9MSN.
Hello.
Slightly different format of podcast to usual, speaking to you from the Cannes Lions. Now, I must admit, I've been running back and forth between press conferences, Mark, so the only session I've seen in full so far is yours. And I kind of found it a bit strange that people queuing out of the doors had to go into Overspill Auditorium to watch it screened on, and then Arianna Huffington was on after you, and hers was half empty.
Is that right? I didn't realise that. It's probably because we promised them free lunch in my session, which of course we didn't actually deliver on. But no, it was a great thing to do for, you know, for PhD. It's the first time PhD's ever been on the stage at Cannes. And you know, we just wanted to sort of put our view forward on what we think the future of media might look like and technology and how it might change things. So hopefully we've kind of, if we haven't fed people's stomachs, we might have fed their minds a little bit.
Well, we'll touch more on the presentation in a minute. It's probably worth catching up on what you've been up to since we last spoke to you. So previously, one of the planning partners at PhD, gone back to the UK a few months ago for the global role. How has the new role gone?
It's good. I'm missing the Australian sunshine, actually. I've had a couple of moments where I've looked back on my time in Australia. I was there for 4 years, and I sort of feel quite sort of it's sort of sad to leave, really. It's you know, it's a beautiful place, and I really like the industry there. It's a real sort of spirited industry. And of course, I'm not actually in a local office now, so I don't actually have P&L responsibility, which is good and bad, really. I'm now in this role where really the contribution that I have to make now is about helping lead the global products for PhD, you know, and that really is about sort of thought pieces, but also systems. One of the big things I want to focus on is building a new planning system for PhD globally that we can all use, and that's going to be a big focus for me over the next year or two.
And do you still get to see some of the PhD Australia work? Do you have any involvement with any of the Australian clients at all?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I don't see it day to day, but any case studies, any sort of, you know, standout work that sort of floats up, I definitely want to have a look at. It's hard for me to actually get involved in each local market office. I mean, we've got 72 offices now, so it's hard to get involved day to day on those. But yeah, anything that's good, I shall try to take all the glory for. That's what I try and do. Made a career out of that so far.
Now, one of the regulars on the Mumbrella Cast is your former colleague Chris Stevenson,
yeah.
Who we had a very intriguing conversation when he told us about the video, which I know as the Evil Kids video.
Yeah.
You probably have another name for it. It sounds like it was a lot more traumatic at your end than
very.
It was from where we were watching Australia. And for those who don't know what we're talking about, it's probably worth explaining.
Oh my God! Right. Yeah, so we, in fact, one of the first things I did when I got into the role was I decided it would be a good idea to. What happened initially, we there was a TED conference, and they had a competition to enter a video that was for a category called infectiously compelling. Any content that is so compelling you've got to send it on. So they said, why don't we get me talking face to camera? And I thought that's a bad idea, so I said, no, to get people to actually watch it, let's give it a bit of sort of edge, and we'll have kids voicing the words of marketing, you know, marketing directors and marketing people, so using all the buzzwords they use and stuff. So we thought that might create a suitable sort of discord in the viewer and make it infectiously compelling.
We'll play a little clip of it.
If you work in marketing, you better start upping your game.
Because you haven't seen anything like us yet.
In just 10 years from now, we'll be buying and influencing buying
in ways that will confound you.
We won't just watch your ads. We'll expect smart, tailored content based on our social graphs.
Tailored for me.
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 And me.
And we put it out. And in fact, it was my idea to put it out on our birthday. So I said, oh, let's use this, put it out on our birthday, you know, get people to tweet it and send it on. I wanted it to provoke and go viral. I had no idea it would. And I had no social infrastructure in place, and no one ready to kind of like deal with any sort of, you know, negative sentiment. So of course it caught fire about 3 or 4 days in. Positive sentiment disappeared. It went purely negative. And we just watched with kind of absolute horror as this thing unfolded. And it was just, and it's a real live example of what clients must go through, you know, when clients have contagion. And interestingly, we saw some, you know, we managed to peek through our fingers and see things like, some of these psychological theories that you hear about, like confirmation bias, this theory that if someone presents something to you and they say, look, this is horrible, watch this, you only see it, you see it in that way. And herd mentality, you know, lots of positive comments to start with. In fact, competitive agencies had positive comments on their homepages of their websites. But when it went negative, everyone quietly removed or retracted or even restated their comments, and we were sort of left out on our own. So, you know, had to sort of fight for ourselves. But it was a remarkable experience, fascinating experience, not necessarily one I would like to repeat again, I think.
You mentioned in your presentation this idea of brand contagion being driven fast by social. Were you actually thinking of that almost as one of the ones you'd lived through?
The ironies of ironies. I mean, we actually put out a book about a year ago called Fluid, and about how with a more connected up world, the speed of information passing around will increase, and with that, so will the chance of brand contagion. So, you know, we were slapped down from our altar, you know, our high sort of fluted position, taking over, sort of being seen to be the experts. We then get slapped right in the face by reality. We had to face social contagion ourselves. And I've always known the power of social networks, but now I feel it. And it's kind of changed me, I think, forever, I think.
The thing that struck me about that video, and we will talk about other things apart from the video in a minute, was from back here in Australia, it seemed kind of fine and a bit provocative and, hey, stand for something, don't retreat from it. Yeah. And it did feel like a bit like maybe you did pull back from it.
We did. I think we made a few mistakes. One of the mistakes, one of the things we would have done in hindsight is we would have just, you know, said, well, this is it, you know, if you don't like it, then that's absolutely fine. And please try and debate the content as well as the execution. But I think we probably were too apologetic, and I think, you know, it became a PR consideration. You know, we had senior PR people involved from Omnicom, and actually, what was really interesting was realizing that all of the fundamentals of PR, the physics of PR and physics of marketing, have changed, because the advice we're getting from PR people was exactly what you wouldn't do, right? And it's very senior PR people saying remove the video, and that was terrible advice, you know. So it highlighted that the world's different. To me, it really, really highlighted that it was different. And I think actually in the UK, the sentiment was very negative. Rest of the world, it really wasn't anywhere near as negative. And I think it's a sign that, you know, content can't work universally in every part of the world. It's always going to be different. You know, in Asia, it was really well liked, but in the UK, they see these kind of middle class kids, you know, using their own buzzwords back on them, you know. It was just, the people just found it unbearable, and it just incited kind of frustration and anger, and people wanted to pass on their aggression, you know.
To advertise with one of the top 10 most loved brands in Australia, visit advertise.ebay.com.au.
Well, let's talk a bit about the presentation you've given at the conference this week. Clearly, that's a 45-minute distillation of a much, much bigger thought process, which I guess was partly driven by, I think you did this as an ebook as well. Where did the sort of journey begin to I guess what is almost like positioning yourself as a futurist?
Well, I mean, I think it's really the fact that if you work for an agency that sets its stall out to be a pioneering agency, to have, you know, to want to sort of push the boundaries, you have to have a view of where it's going, right? You can't choose not to. So I think it sort of came out of our positioning. PhD's essence is pioneering. That's the word that was kind of is the beating heart word for PhD as a brand, and it's expressed as finding a better way. And so we have to have a view. I mean, you know, we can't. If clients ask us, well, where do you think it's going? We can't say we don't know. So it came out of the core essence of PhD, and it's become something that I was never particularly that interested in 4 or 5 years ago. Really, I've only gradually over time become sort of addicted to sort of, you know, information about the future. And so, yeah, it's kind of emerged that way, I think.
Okay, well, let's talk about a few. I found myself, as you were giving the presentation, sort of making bullet points, and I realised I was just writing down pretty much everything you said, which wouldn't have been that good for a podcast, really, but was quite flattering at the content. This is maybe where I'll widen it to Danny at this point as well. One of the early points for me was fibre to the home and the difference that's going to make, which obviously politically in Australia means, you know, is it inextricably linked up to the national broadband network as well. What do you see the future being around that, Danny? Is it as central as the argument that Mark makes, for instance?
Absolutely. I think what the network will bring to Australia in terms of from a consumer perspective, what it will do for brands, what it will do for business in general is sensational. I mean, we do lag behind the rest of the world when it comes to speed. And if you look at, you know, an example of most of the things that Mark spoke about today, they will only survive with that infrastructure being put in place. Without that, they will never happen. So it's as important as some of the major engineering works that were taken out in the 50s, the hydroelectric dams, etc., etc. Without that infrastructure in place, Australia will go back. And it's more important now than ever before that everyone gets behind this.
And Alex, it's your business really, isn't it? How do you see it as actually transforming the way that your company does business?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously with the greater speed, more transactional online. One of the interesting buzzwords that sort of Mark came up with today is around this T-commerce, you know, television commerce, the next sort of advent of interactivity and retail across the internet, but actually via TVs. And so as those internet-connected televisions over the next few years become dominant in the households, how we actually push content through those and how we actually push products and services through those is going to be changing at a massively rapid rate, and so it's one that we've really got to be on the ball on.
Well, Mark, that was one of the bullet points I did write down, was T-commerce. Maybe just explain a bit more what your thinking was around it, the point that you were making about
it. It's simply the fact that with internet-enabled televisions, if you're watching the content, there's no reason at all why you can't have an overlay, an IP overlay over the top of the content. We've seen it already in some of the early connected TVs. If that's the case, if there's anything you're watching within a TV program, why not be able to have something that overlays that you can click on to find more about it? It feels to me that feels like something that I would do, and I think it's quite a good you know, sense check. Just intuitively, does it sort of, you know, pass the sniff test? You know, would you want to better click on stuff occasionally to find out more information about them? Yes, you probably would. Is there a commercial benefit to that? Well, if you can then if someone can capture the data of my intent, I'm interested in that. Then yes, there is a commercial model attached to it. And if you can actually buy in that environment, then of course there's a fantastic commercial model. So there's a commercial model, there's a consumer benefit. I can't see why it wouldn't happen. It's been termed T-commerce, not by me, by someone else that I read, and they predicted in the US it'd be $8 billion industry by 2016, I think they said. So just extrapolating out from there, it could be sort of $15, $16 billion industry globally. So for me, I think it's a fascinating thought that it's kind of a new retail channel, isn't it? You know, and it also makes me think that you might find producers of content produce content and invest in the content just because they know they've got products in there, product placed products, that they know they can then layer embedded content on and even sell through. So it means TV could effectively be a retail channel.
Now, you just touched on this at the start, but it kind of addresses that. This question of, in the end, it's up to consumers with any product. We talk about a particular technology, but they either take to it or they don't.
Yeah.
And I was kind of trying to think of examples where you thought it was going to be the future and then it didn't, you know, like WAP for a while, or, you know, it's probably only 5 years ago or something was going to be the thing that drove consumers and wasn't. What is it? What's the defining point? What makes a technology succeed or fail?
I don't know. My thought on it is, the best I can do on it on this is to think that, well, to start with, technology doesn't drive us, we drive it. So that's why I'm ultimately a technology optimist, because I think that it's only there to serve us, right? We're not there to serve it. And I think that technology serves us best when it liberates us. And if you think about the sort of three-dimensional world that we live in, we're sort of bounded by sort of three dimensions. We can't be everywhere at any given time. We have access to information, but it's certainly not unlimited. We can't access all the world's information in any moment. And we can be with friends, but again, you know, as long as we make sure we kind of fix up the time to meet them, we can't be with everyone in the moment. If you imagine a state where you can be everywhere with everyone, with every piece of information, in a sort of unbounded kind of like oneness, that state would probably be a state where you wouldn't necessarily need to evolve from. So at that point there, evolution would probably have served its purpose. So if you just use that sort of piece of sort of like, you know, nonsense theory to predict what will work, so any technology that will work will somehow allow us to move one step further to that kind of state that I just described. And if you use that paradigm, you can assess technologies and kind of think, you know, is this really going to work? Are people really going to use this? Does it really liberate us, empower us? And I think if you can apply that, then you can start to think what might work, what won't work, will just fall away at the edges.
I also wondered actually where you were using the example of everyone, everywhere, and I forgot what the
everything.
Third, everything was. It sounded vaguely like something like, I wasn't sure that it was Buddhism or the opposite of Buddhism.
It is a bit, yeah, Kabbalah probably. No, it is. Yeah, it's you know, when if you read about some of these kind of, you know, mystical sort of like, you know, religions, and you know, people find a sense of what's the word, you know, stillness, and they don't need to kind of keep evolving onwards, and it's almost as if technology is leading us in that direction. I mean, this is probably a conversation for alcohol more than coffee.
Well, perhaps later tonight
we'll talk about it. But I have to say that I think that there is probably some sort of journey that we're on that, you know, we're not all aware of, but it is some sort of journey in that direction. And technology actually enables us to get there.
Well, Alex, I noticed that you suddenly started to make urgent notes as we were talking about connectiveness. So I hope it wasn't that you were forgetting your shopping list, but there was a point that you were hoping to make.
Yeah, no, I just think, you know, when you do think about the advent of NBN and the ability for consumers to really connect with products in a real-time environment, you add into that natural interfaces such as Microsoft's Kinect, it really will, you know, in the next sort of 5 to 10 years,
come
it's
on,
really
going to... Is that a really naked product, no, like, such as Microsoft's Kinect?
No. Well, like the Kinect, I mean, it really will, be quite a change. And you think about, you know, the kids today, you know, my kids, for example, they don't really use a PC, they only use an iPad. They don't really know what that is. So I wonder what they'll sort of grow up with regards to retail. Will they be going down to the Westfields, or will they be going down to the other shopping malls, or will they be actually touching things on the screen or pointing to things on the screen and actually saying, I want to buy that now?
And Danny, do you think that instant connectiveness is going to be the next driver?
Look, I do, because I think consumers are demanding that. And if you look at the issues that most publishers now face, you know, the traditional model of the newspaper every morning, or even the model from the last 10 years from websites, that's changing as well now. The way people want their content delivered is the biggest issue that major media companies face now. To your point earlier about, you know, why does some technology work and others don't? One of the seminars this morning which you missed was Malcolm Gladwell.
Yes, I caught some of it in the press centre of that.
Yeah, he spoke about, you know, the human compulsion to be number one, and he argued against that, and he said, well, you shouldn't try to be number one; you should try to be number three. And he gave a number of examples, none of which I'll be able to get anywhere near to the level that he told them. But, you know, one of the things he spoke about was...
Was Facebook? Was that one of the examples?
Look, he spoke about social media and Friendster, and then Friendster being superseded by MySpace. MySpace learned from Friendster, and then Facebook came along, learned from them both, and Facebook is what it is today. You know, he spoke about e-readers and what Amazon did, you know, looking at the first and second generation of e-readers. He actually spoke about the 1982 Israeli war with Syria.
That was the bit I caught. Yeah, where, without the context ahead of it, was I was wondering for a while whether I picked up the right feed.
Yeah, and look, ultimately what he was saying was, you know, the situation that is, this is very deep, isn't it, for the fact that we're in the south of France. Absolutely. And, you know, he spoke about what culminated in that war and the reason that Israel won, etc., etc. But his whole piece today was, what makes certain things successful is not that the people actually invent that technology or have the original idea. It's they look at what's gone on before them and tweak it. And he used this word, you know, who's doing the tweaking? And I think the examples we show today, what Steve Jobs did with Xerox, he was the guy who went to Xerox in 1975, 76, saw what they'd done with a mouse and with pixels and thought, you know what, this is what is missing from personal computers. So he didn't come up with that. He saw it and saw the opportunity it gave.
And that also sounds like perhaps it's the topic for Malcolm Gladwell's next book. You know,
absolutely.
He's got the thought, hasn't he?
And, you know, Mark, you talk about NFC today. You know, did NFC look at cue codes and go, yeah, it's nearly there, but it's not exactly there?
NFC, near field
communications. So, you know, what Mark said, and I think one of the things that's come through in the four presentations I've seen today is just how technology is driving everything. And, you know, NFC could be the big game changer for mobile. For years now, we've said this is the year of mobile. It's never happened. It's happening now. And I think things like NFC will absolutely drive that.
And Mark, you were making the point with NFC that it's not just about... Well, Google Wallet is a good example of it, you know, using it to make payments, but it'll be about more than that. And then it starts tying into learning data about consumers that way.
and perhaps persuading them to be less protective of their data, their privacy as well.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, Google have launched this thing called, I think it's called Hotpot. I can't remember what the name was, but it's basically they're NFC enabled posters, and they've got them. They're trialing them in Portland in the US, and they have. So if you go to Portland in the US, you see these posters everywhere, shops, restaurants, cafes, whatever. And then if you walk around, you can just check yourself in. As long as you've got a Nexus S, I think, is that right? You can check yourself in automatically. And I think my own sense is that might represent the future of check-ins, because I think Foursquare has been incredibly successful, considering for what it is, you know what I mean?
How do you feel about Foursquare? And I'll ask you two guys as well. Do you get anything out of it?
Well, I mean, I used it to start with when it first launched, and then I just gave up. I hate the thought of being an oversharer. You know these people on social network sites that keep kind of communicating with me. I'm having a ham sandwich at the moment. Yum, yum. I don't like writing those things because I just find them frustrating. But I think some people have enjoyed using it, Foursquare, because it allows them to inform people of where they are.
And for those who aren't familiar with Foursquare, that's the location-based social marketing tool. Tell people where you are right now.
Exactly, that's right. But they are, at the point when it was starting to look like it was losing its way, they then switched on this kind of other part of the business where you can now look at reviews of places based on where people have checked in. So it's starting to use the data, but... I don't know. I mean, I sense that, the Malcolm Gladwell example, they might be sort of the first or second. You know, you had Google had Latitude, launched Latitude, but that was in its very early stages, and then sort of Foursquare comes along. But I can imagine that there'll be a third or even fourth one that'll come along that will really crack it. I think Google probably will get close to cracking it, because, you know, the distribution of Android, I think 2016, you know, 5 years from now, you will just simply find checking points all over the place, and there'll be benefits for checking in. I think this movement towards sharing your data, because at the moment people kind of like give out their data, but I think they don't necessarily see much back for it. It doesn't need to be obvious stuff like micropayments and things. It can be, I mean, even like Facebook Connect. If I connect into places' websites, I can connect in really quickly and efficiently. That is that holds a bit of value to me, and that's the value exchange. That, in order to share a bit of my data, I'm happy with. But I think it does. The whole area of privacy is a very interesting debate, and I think it'd be interesting how it unfolds over the next few years. And there's a possibility that people might become more liberal.
Danny, just going back to the Foursquare point. Yeah, you've used it. You use it.
I have used it. I think it's a generational thing as well. I think I'm hurtling towards 40 and still have
There's
some
nothing wrong with being
no
40.
No and still have some reservations about what I'm prepared to put up on a site like Facebook or Foursquare. I think 10-year-olds, 15-year-olds today, as they move into whatever social network they choose, will have much less hesitation in putting that information up there. And I think if you look at what's happened with the Facebook check-in, that's probably superseded Foursquare in a lot of ways. I think there's enormous opportunity, particularly for local smaller businesses, with things like Foursquare and Places and check-in, etc. But I think it's more of a generational thing that the digital natives coming through are much more open and feel much more secure in putting massive amounts of personal data up on a social network site.
And Alex, are you over Foursquare?
Look, I sort of got on there when it was new, but don't really use it. And I think I've got to agree with Mark that, it's probably, in terms of how Malcolm Gladwell views the world, it's probably one of those earlier innovation type companies at the moment. He sort of split it between innovation and implementation. Innovation companies tend to be, relatively well cashed up at the moment, able to apply resources to actually drive new innovations. And yet they don't have the sort of nimbleness and they don't have the desperation to really take those mass market. And that's where the sort of tinklers come along and take those ideas and actually push those out. So I'd be interested to sort of see what happens next with, maybe it was Foursquare, maybe it's then, Google's hotspots, who knows what's going to come next. But it's certainly one of those areas that if you take Malcolm's work, you think that's got to fit firmly into sort of stage two of a three-stage process.
I also think there's a big opportunity for search, whether that be Bing or Google, to replicate that model as well.
And now, Mark, you touched on this. It's probably worth just exploring a little bit more, because it was kind of, I think, a key element in what you were saying about privacy. the fact that people are maybe feeling the next generation may be a little bit less wary, a little bit less shy about what they are willing to share?
I think that, I mean, there's always going to be individuals that will be, you know, concerned about releasing their data. And the problem is that the people that are most concerned are obviously the most vociferous, and there's a tendency for us to over-assume how conscious and anxious people are. If you speak, most people of my sort of generation, I don't know how you guys feel about it, but they're kind of like, well, you know, I give a bit of data out, but, you know, I don't really care. I've got nothing to hide, right? And it's not as if, you know, we sort of know that, you know, there aren't any sort of dark overlords sitting in some room pouring through our data, you know, with a glass of whiskey by a fire and sort of going, oh, right, I'm going to really exploit these people. Because the reality is the people that are looking at those data are people like me, and I don't care about what individuals are doing, you know, what sandwiches they've bought. So the reality is people don't care, and I think it's probably people that have a predisposition to be conspiracy theorists are those that probably are more likely to be anxious about what we might be doing with the data. I think younger generations will just get more, it will just get more used to sharing data, as long as they see a resultant benefit for it. I think that's the crucial thing. I think it's for us as an industry to respect their data and obviously use it in appropriate ways, but also to make sure there's a sort of value exchange.
Now, one of the final points of your presentation, which actually I thought was particularly intriguing because it's something I'd not heard people really say before, was this idea that people often talk to, hey, will media and advertising come back together in the full service agency? You were actually arguing the opposite, that we may actually see media agencies even split. You know, there's the ones who are all about managing and trading the data versus those who come from the other point of view.
Yeah, I mean, you can see it already. I mean, you know, if you look at the search departments of today and, you know, of the last few years, you look in the eyes of people in SEM, they're the people that are going to be running a whole significant part of the media agency of the future. If you're the CEO of a media agency at the moment, you're effectively still a CEO of a people-based business. And I think 5 years, even 10 years from now, you'll be the CEO of a software-based business. It's really going that way. This, you know, automation, real-time trading, you know, the likes, the systems that we'd be using, the face of the media agency is going to change dramatically, and actually it won't squash out creativity. When people hear that, they go, "Oh, it sounds terrible." What about the creativity? That will still exist, and it will flourish because people will start to really be able to identify disproportionate ROI investments, and they'll be looking to get more of those. And the only way anywhere they come from is innovation. I can't think of another way you get disproportionate ROI. So innovation will be put under the spotlight more, and will be generating that more. I think you'll probably find media agencies will have very two halves. There'll be, you know, the software trading kind of, you know, real-time bidding teams, and then you'll have people that are probably servicing clients but coming up with innovation ideas.
And the trading teams, could you see that going to a group level, for instance? I think that's almost what you were saying.
Yeah, I think so. I think there's a possibility. I mean, you sort of see signs of it already, really, with sort of, you know, media agencies pulling their search teams together into sort of combined groups that run across the whole of that, you know, advertising or marketing services group, you know. I can see an opportunity for groups to basically combine all of their real-time bidding people together and actually have them pulled together into one group, and but then keep very separated media agencies for the servicing of clients and innovation. If that happens, then the innovation element of the media agency will then be completely kind of disconnected from the trading, and will really drive them on a path to compete with the creative agencies. That will be a very interesting thing to see. And, you know, in 10 years from now, you might find actually creative or media agencies, they're actually pretty much the same thing. They just have different histories, you know, and they'll be presenting and pitching for the same work.
And Danny, I guess that's almost the path that, in many ways, Group M is beginning to take, I suppose.
Yeah, it's that phrase, mad men versus math men, that's been kicked around quite a bit recently. And you know, to Mark's point, you know, we're absolutely seeing the investment into our agencies being driven by that need for people who understand the DSP and what that then means for a wider
DSP demand side platforms.
So the trading desk. But you know, it's obvious to see that if or when the DSP is working to full capacity, any media can be traded through that system. Now, the time frame of that is to be decided. But you know, TV is digital now. Outdoor is moving more and more digital now. Radio is moving digital now. So theoretically, anything that can be traded through a platform such as a DSP can go in there regardless of the actual media. Our responsibility, and this is where the madmen come back in, although some of the guys who work in search could probably be classed as madmen as well. We certainly need, from a digital perspective, to demonstrate to clients that digital is there to build brands, to have a conversation with the consumer. It's not a direct response vehicle. Of course, cost per click, cost per acquisition, CPW, cost per whatever, will always be at the forefront of a lot of marketers' minds, because we are transparent, and that was our biggest strength 15 years ago when we arrived on the scene. And in some ways, it's our biggest hindrance now, because marketers look at it as, that's fine, I'll invest X as long as I get Y back. So we've got to make sure that balance is there, and we've got to make sure that brands look at digital in all its forms when they're thinking of a product launch or a campaign above and beyond the cost per click metric.
Now, we relatively soon will be out of time. Just one other point I wanted to, maybe one or two more points I wanted to cover, Mark. You mentioned the idea of media futures exchanges, this idea of actually trading inventory, presumably whether you're predicting there's going to be an oversupply or an undersupply. I can see media owners being terrified by that thought, as it kind of sounds very much like the whole thing would be commoditized. Yeah. Was that the point you were making?
Yeah, it was a point that was originally made by Alex Spurzum, who's our head of search and screen-based trading in PitchD Australia. Incredibly smart man who came to me one day and said that he's had this thought about where it inevitably will go. And he's one of these individuals that when he has thoughts like that, you listen. And it really intrigued me. And I think there's something, you know, it might not happen, do you know what I mean? But you just sense that when there's so much biddable-based inventory and it's being traded with real-time bidding software systems using algorithms, and many people, you know, in the marketplace, you know, you've got data providers, you've got inventory providers in the form of media owners, and you've got clients, and you've got agencies. It starts to feel very much like a stock exchange or a market. Depending on which way the wind blows, I can imagine over the next 5 years it could quite easily go in that direction. And you could find agencies long and shorting, you know, the cost of, you know, buying audiences, you know, because at the moment, you know, in demand side platforms, we're obviously bidding for audience data, cookie data, before we even bid for the inventory. So there's a lot to bid for and a lot of stuff that's the price that's moving. So, it seems like something that could happen. And I think that even if it could happen, it's a very, very intriguing thought. And of how that, you know, that might unfold, and how it might change the media agency model.
Now, if you're a media owner, do you feel threatened by that?
Oh, look, I think over the next 5 years, for publishers, for agencies, for advertisers, and also more importantly for consumers, we're going to see a rapid amount of change from where we are today to where we're going to be then. I think, you know, some of that change represents really good opportunities for places like 9MSN, who can sort of take the first step and help sort of lead the market in whichever way it goes, which is more beneficial to enable those advertisers to connect with, you know, true segments, true audiences online. And I think that's something that we're really excited about.
Well, then, just the final point. I thought I'd ask Danny and then Alex. From Mark's sort of future gazing presentation that we've seen today, if there was a single thought that you took from it, or that you were left, or made you think, actually, that's the point I'm going to have to think about when I get to my desk, what would it be?
The notion of gamification really, really jumped out at me, and, you know, with the rise of social media and the change in the conversation between a brand and a consumer, I think gamification's the logical next step to that. So I think we as agencies need to ensure that, one, our clients are prepared for that, because it's a big leap to allow consumers that much control over someone's brand. But consumers are demanding it. The conversation needs to change, and as a result, I think the whole notion of gamification will be one of the major changes over the next couple of years.
And Alex?
Yeah, I think longer term, I can't remember what the term was, but it was around the algorithmic modelling, which is sort of an overlay across everything, and using data and using algorithms to help predict what's going to happen in terms of online. And I think for me, that is extremely interesting. And if you can sort of use that to better predict movement pattern in online behaviour, that opens up some huge opportunities for publishers and for advertisers to know when they should be connecting with those consumers. And from consumers, if they get a more relevant and contextually relevant experience, that's really good for them as well. So it's sort of a win-win-win situation.
And Mark, finally, with the lot of thoughts you gave us to kind of grapple there, if there's a single one that you were hoping your audience kind of came away with, what was it going to be?
God, there's quite a few thoughts. I mean, I have to say gamification is the thing that I'm most excited about at the moment. I think reading a book at the moment called Reality is Broken by a woman, I can't remember her name, but you'd find it. And I just think it's amazing. I think, you know, it's where we plug our minds into the networks and we are, the force of power of like the human intellect is unleashed. Malcolm Gladwell in his previous book, The Outliers, he said that it takes 10,000 hours to become an expert in anything. Have you seen that book? And he said if you look at the typical gamers, he said by the time people get to 20, they've done 10,000 hours of gaming. So they are you know, experts on collaboration and, you know, solving issues against all odds. So we are, you know, we've got a generation now of these incredible minds. And we just need to put them to the use of society. You know, I mean, they're already being used to fold proteins now. Games are being built on top of things to help, you know, us do stuff in the world, you know, good stuff in the world. And I think it's phenomenal opportunities to unleash rampant engagement with gamification.
That, unfortunately, is where we're going to have to leave it. Thank you very much, Mark.
Thank you.
Thank you to Danny.
Thank you.
And thank you to Alex.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
And the Mumbrella Cast returns next week. I'm Tim Burrows. Toodle-pip.